Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. First, I speed read the news so we can get straight into the Stalic episode, and then we're joined by people who've been on the road to Stalic, we're joined by the organizers, we're joined by the Melee winner, we're joined by the Joust finalists, we're joined by the European Team Championship winners. Basically, all 300 Stalic attendees are here. All right, this is episode 27, and, well, a lot to go over. If you managed to miss episode 26, it wasn't posted in the usual ways because CardGameDB was down that week. It's still available on CardGameDB, available through the RSS feed. That's our post-Worlds recap. Lots of great stuff in there. This week, my co-hosts have abandoned me. I'm doing the entire Stalic episode by myself, and I'm not at all bitter. They're actually playing in the Red Saturday tournament. John made the cut. And at the time I'm recording this, I think Sean was 10th. So I don't know how that will have ended. That was a tournament including Valor, so hopefully we'll get some thoughts from them fairly shortly on how Valor played out. I also want to start with an erratum. I guess start is a little late. We're already 3 points in. But I'm trying to fly through this so that we can get to the meat of the Stalic episode. So John had mentioned that Tim Sherm would have won overall at Worlds. That's definitely not the case. In fact, it looks like it would have been Ryan Wood from the UK, who not only won the UK National Championships, came second at the Battle of Blackwater Bay, he made the cut in both Melee and Joust at Worlds, and now he made the cut at both Melee and Joust at Stalic. So he may well be the player of the year if we had some objective way of evaluating that. So congratulations to Ryan Wood. Official news from FFG, the applications for regionals have been posted. In some of the locations, we'll be able to apply for a two-day regional format with a second format, presumably Melee. I'm very much looking forward to see if we can get support from stores on that and start making regionals very big events. There's no excuse not to. The Battle of the Trident has mostly played out, at least in North America. Locations internationally can still play it until, I believe, December 10th, but don't quote me on that. Unfortunately, in my own Battle of the Trident, I was beaten, and the Red Fork dominated our local Battle of the Trident, despite my best efforts. The very final match, I lost to a nasty little Greyjoy Sun. Other interesting news, I got an article up on the main FFG site called The Old World and the New, comparing the differences in the meta in Europe and North America. I had a lot of fun writing it. FFG did a good job sprucing up the graphics and making it look all pretty full, so please do check that out. I think it's an interesting way of looking at the game. The other official FFG website stuff, the European Championships have been announced for next year. They'll be happening in Birmingham in the UK. So this is for all of FFG's lines of games. And so this is new. A lot of games didn't have a European Championship, and now they will. Obviously, Game of Thrones has had a European Championship unofficially or officially throughout the years, Stalic, and that may affect it, although as we talk about later in this episode, probably won't make much of a difference. Valor is intended to come out. The fourth chapter pack is coming out on December 1st. That is the street date. And we have plenty of tournaments I could recap the results on. Lots and lots of tournaments have been played because of the Battle of the Trident, but we also have big ones like Chilean Nationals. But this is the Stalic episode, so those tournaments sort of get shunted aside as we talk about Stalic. And that was the entire news in 3 minutes, speed read by Istra. I thought we would start off our Stalic commentary with actually the road to Stalic, and I'm joined by the self-proclaimed Captain of the Westeros Globetrotters. This is Ben Fox from Ireland. Who on earth travels to that many road to Stalic tournaments, Ben?
Well, I suppose the Irish do, more or less. So, like for myself, like I did most of the road to Stalic, everything except for Italy, because that sounded like it was going to be cancelled for a while, and then when it was announced, it was in very short notice, and the Italian tournament happened to be held in Italy. where the flights cost all the money. And
that and all the Italian Ryanair airports are at least 2 hours from the city they're in.
Oh, there's a few of those. Like that was actually tricky enough, like actually learning the ins and outs of making it to the tournaments, because they almost tried to trick us like that going into Paris, where the Paris airport for Ryanair is basically Dublin. So, yeah, that was the connection I had to be very sure to get right.
Excellent. I may be completely wrong here, but you're new to second edition. You didn't play the first edition.
Yeah, I used to play the collectible card game, and we played the CCG quite heavily until they just wouldn't stop printing kill effects. So around the time characterless decks started winning tournaments, we started asking ourselves questions as to why we're playing. And then by the time the LCG rolled around, we had long quit and developed a bitterness towards it. And then I got tempted to come into the game because I saw it and there was a certain element of nostalgia. But by the time I finally caved and had the first few cards arrived, they announced second edition. So I just waited for that, and I've been playing second edition since Worlds.
And I remember seeing some posts on the Facebook group of some Abdul Al-Azred, which I believe is a Lovecraftian name, if I'm not mistaken, saying, you know, hey, I think I'm going to attend all these Road to Stalag tournaments. What do you guys think about that? So that was in your mind, like, in January?
That kind of lined up in January that way. Well, part of it is I work for a very multinational company, and I noticed in January, just looking at my bookings, like that I was scheduled to play in a different country every month for the first quarter of the year. So suddenly it was a question of, all right, I'm scheduled to play in a different country for the first quarter, and there's all these international tournaments happening. How far can I stretch it?
Apparently so, everywhere but Italy.
Stretched out then and see like if I could actually do a tournament in a different country every month for the whole tournament season. So 11 countries, 11 months. And came pretty close.
Fantastic. So, I mean, you've witnessed the local hospitality, the local flavor of the game in all of these countries. You've been to your first Stalag this year. Just some thoughts about how that whole experience went.
Yeah, like a lot of it was really interesting, actually, even on the road to Stalag itself, because it might sound like a very uniform and focused journey to a lot of people. But many of the tournaments kind of have their own very separate ideas, even from an organizational viewpoint, of what the organizers believe that they are intended to be. So you have kind of the ones that intend to be just enormous, massive events like your Battaglia or your Fracas. But then you also have on the outskirts of it, you have Varberg, where it historically has been quite small, in part because Sweden's really far away and expensive, but also because the organizers are actually quite happy to have a kind of scaled-down version of that, so where you still have the focused competition, but without kind of, you know, in some elements, just blissful exhaustion of the hundreds and hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it also did allow them to do things like have a best-of-three final and things like that, that you know, the other tournaments can't necessarily do when you have 140 people.
Well, the best of three finals are still possible, and they're like, it's a question of how do you structure it. So along kind of my trip, it was interesting seeing the different elements of what has been done in tournaments and where it has been done well. So for example, Stalag itself has an incredible sense of occasion, because just coming back from that and having been there, it has this immense feeling of importance. And this is something quite unlike any of the tournaments around that. Even at Worlds, like in part, it seems just something that has to be done because, you know, they promised it. And this year's one was actually run really, really well. But with Stalag, like, because you have so many events, because you're jumping through it, there's this enormous focus to ensure that the game is appreciated from every aspect. And that's reflected in the player base themselves. So, like, if you saw the photos of the winning Greek team for the European Team Championship, mm-hmm. Like the joy and the celebration from it is something you would only really see kind of major sporting events. Like, it's something unrivaled. Like, I didn't see anything like that anywhere else in the world.
That event is definitely their baby, and I just heard this in my last interview, so I'm going to have to ask them about it. But I even heard that there was a proposal.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to press them for details. But that certainly doesn't sound like any event I've attended yet.
But that's where, you know, kind of drives people to that, because you have that community where a lot of the players will travel almost solely for the people, like, and there is intense competition, like, and there's some exceptional players and great deck builders are coming out for this, but this is where people have some of their closest friends, you know, this is where people decide to move countries to be closer to each other, this is where people go off and they propose an event like this because it's such a huge part of their social milieu, where they have an occasion where the people that matter are already there and they want to share the celebration with them before almost anyone else.
Well, that's a wonderful way of putting it. I like that a lot. I'm not even sure we can continue beyond that, or I have to cut that to the end of the interview. It's really a sentiment. But I guess, I mean, I played in 5 different countries this year, and you put me to shame. So, although some of them was only a single match. But I guess the question is, from the takeaway from that, what does your next year look like?
Well, I'd say the next year is going to be quieter. Like, again, like my...
Quieter is a relative thing. You just you could still go to 10 tournaments and it would be quieter.
Yeah, like next year, like I'm in the process of moving to the new world. Like, so I'd say I'm going to be exploring a bit more of the Western meta, like, and seeing the differences and kind of events they run there. And I've already seen quite a bit of an expansion of the U.S. tournaments and where people are stepping up and creating their own huge events. So there's one, for example, I'm really looking forward to in February, where I have an open invitation to Thrones War, which is being run by the Californian.
Yes, that's by the
SoCal crew.
Yeah, that looks like a blast. And the house cards they had last year with the Disney characters just really embodies, you know, the California's. You know, that's where it's from, but a really good take on Thrones. I very much appreciated what they've done for that.
Yeah, so in part, like, it's got to be kind of continuing this National Geographic approach to Thrones tournaments, like, of being able to provide people with some sense of what each event is, because every one of them has a different personality. You know, eventually see if I can get lucky enough to make it out to the Southeast Asian end, because they're also building their own one, and that's phenomenal just seeing the game take off in such a huge way, because I know there is a substantial undercurrent of 1.0 bitter vets.
Really?
And like there's quite a bit of an upset at how different the game is from first edition, and it's a discussion I had like at Stalic and quite a few points along the way, saying that the new edition has a different balance when it comes to luck, for example. But that's something, like, because people discuss it as being worse or being better, depending on what side of the argument they're on. But ultimately, like, it's a decision in the design of the game. Because in any game you play, the worst players have to have a chance at beating the better ones.
Well, that's why there's not much casual chess play between good players and bad players, right? That's just...
Exactly right. Like, you know, like, I played chess quite a lot growing up. Like, I was trained to play chess back in Russia, where, you know, it was borderline religion at the time. It's so structured. Whereas here, once you switch the balance, then you see where the weaker players can win enough to be interested. And you saw this in a huge expansion of the player base. Like, when you have the tournaments, Fracas went to in excess of 160 players from less than half of that the year before.
Correct, yeah.
And a lot of them are expanding at an enormous rate, and still you see the top players win time and again.
Well, as a point to that, because since you attended the Road to Stalic, in the top 32 of Stalic, or all but 2 of the Road to Stalic winners were in the top 32.
Yeah. Yeah, but even there, like, if you look, for example, and, you know, Ryan Woods, who was in the cut at Worlds, who was in the cut at Stalic, who was at the final table in Melee, who was the UK national champion.
He was the runner-up in the Battle of Blackwater Bay.
Yeah, and like, if you're talking about there being too much luck in the game, well, where is it? when you're seeing Tomas Albeck, you know, set his sights on being the top Night's Watch player and then continuously doing well with Night's Watch, even when we were told that they weren't any good. You know, he was making the cut with Night's Watch all the way back in Paris. Like, I know it's kind of hilarious to say all the way back, like something that's happened really just a
February,
few months ago.
March, yeah, exactly.
He's able to make that happen. And that's, again, a reflection of how the good players can still get it done. And yes, there is that much more luck. And yes, you will have even somebody like Jakob Hultman miss the cut in Stalek.
On strength of schedule.
Yeah. But when you have something like this, like, it opens the game up to the players and it still continuously takes the top players, you know, to the mountaintop.
You said something at the start of this. You said continuing your sort of National Geographic approach. When do we start getting a Ben Fox narrated documentary with the meta? This is the Californian player in his native elements. Maybe David Attenborough might join in.
Yeah, well, we kind of started on that on the Fox and Victor show in Varberg. So we'll see. Like, I was talking to some of the guys on the Caucasian Book podcast about putting together an article kind of on the scene overall and just giving people a guide as to what is the right tournament for them based on what they want out of the game. So where you'd have, for example, something like Dockside Brothel Days, which is just incredibly chill, and you're in a ridiculously relaxed country in a smaller tournament that still has some international focus. You know, like, where this year we got to play in the basement of a not-for-profit pub, which to me as an Irishman is just a bizarre concept.
Yeah.
On the other side, you would have something like Batalla, which is a massive celebration of the game in the pure Spanish style of where you can wander up to the tournament organizers, ask them, when does this thing actually finish, because you got to catch up flights that day. And the answer is 4:30. Well, definitely 5. Every year we finish by 6, because that's when the place closes. But we do bribe the security guard to stay later, and you essentially walk away knowing less than you did going in. But
I lived in Spain for a year. What you're describing is not unfamiliar to me.
Yeah, and like, that's where, but you're seeing kind of all the components as well, and something that the tournaments have done great and something that has been built upon. So, for example, in Batalla was the first time we saw the table prizes, and I thought those were great, kind of starting from round 4 onwards, giving everybody something to play for in every round, even if they can no longer make the cut, even if they can no longer make day 2, whatever their personal goal is. And I thought, like, Worlds actually delivered that in the best way possible. Some of the table prizes they were putting out were spectacular.
Yeah, as I understand it, in Worlds, it was sort of an escalation. You know, early rounds was playing for an Altard Varus or something from the regional kit or the game kits, and later rounds was some of the really cool, you know, Winds of Winter and things like that for every match. I my only criticism of Worlds is I think this should be advertised beforehand. I think they should push this thing. I think they should say there's going to be these top of house prizes. There's going to be something to play for at the table. I think they're selling themselves short.
Yeah, I think communication is something where FFG kind of have struggled quite a bit along the way. Like, and in terms of getting through to the player base, I think the Stalek crew are doing that much more.
Well, I for one look forward to Ben Fox / David Attenborough narrated National Geographic of Thrones players, and I do hope you get a chance to go to the Southeast Asia leg of the Marine stuff or the like. Managed to swing that. I would love to have another perspective, an outside perspective on those ones as well.
Cool, man. And it's been a pleasure.
Third time we've done this, gathering as many people as possible to talk about Stalek. The person who has to talk to us about Stalek, of course, is Wolfgang here for the third time. This is not his first rodeo. But a year ago, when you were last on, you said the future of Stalek was uncertain. That you weren't sure it could grow to support the community, that there were problems going forward. What's the update now?
Oh, it's no longer uncertain. The thing was, it became too big for one person to handle. So last year I really struggled. So the idea came up to have a team. and Remco is part of the team, and we are seven in this group, and the responsibilities have been distributed among us, and it worked fine. Now I can say I would be very happy to do it again.
Excellent, and that segues nicely. So we're also joined by Remco, who was one of the organizers this year. So what tasks were distributed to you, Remco?
I was mostly into player communication, making sure the Facebook page was up to date, talking to the people of the Road to Starlink, so that we have all the things we needed to run a smooth Starlink.
Yeah, the Road to Starlink did change a little bit this year. You guys had at least one new addition. Well, the Italian leg changed names and changed organizers and so on. Did that work out well?
Yeah, they did a wonderful job in Italy, I think. Hoping to see them back next year.
All right. Well, Wolfgang, you got some support from other players. I know that you said that you had to look forward because you have to book this so far in advance. You weren't sure about there being a European championship, and now there's some more information about that. But this year you guys got card designs, you got the official FFG support, and it looks like the tournament was a blast. You know, preliminary reports are in and people are enjoying it.
Yeah, definitely. It actually was FFG or Asmodee that finally approached us and offered this card design and support by
and that
them.
Was for both the Melee and the Joust.
If I remember correctly, that was Helmut's part, actually.
Okay, well, and then he deserves credit for that. The year after he makes the final table, he makes sure that there's a card design. So I guess the question for both of you as attendees and as organizers, aside from having the organizing committee, what was different this year? We've already done the sort of the history of Stalic in our first episode with you, Wolfgang. So what was different this year as opposed to previous years?
I think one of the most important things is we had a maximum of players. We set a limit to it, and this was good because, well, we had a limit of 300 because of the hall. The limit was reached within a few hours after registration started.
Yeah, I saw that. I imagine that might actually help with organization. If you know you're going to have basically 300 people for having prize support, for having calculating bathroom usage and things like that, you know your threshold rather than being, well, it'll be somewhere north of 200, right?
It helped for prize support, as you mentioned, yeah. Not for facility stuff like bathrooms or so, because the castle, which is a youth hostel, has been booked out for years already. Many players have to go to hotels anyway.
And Remco, was there anything that you would say was different this year, either as a player or as an organizer?
As a player, I think it was my first time was 2013, so this is my fourth Stalic, and I think I met more new faces this year than I met last year and the year before, and that's encouraging.
Of course, we had this change from first edition to second edition.
True.
That makes big change in the players.
So that's maybe a good one to touch on. So I guess that's one of the big differences is this year 1.0 was a side event. How did 2.0 go? How did it change the feel or the ambiance of the thing? Was there a lot of nostalgia? Was it thick with, oh, I miss this, or this is an inferior game right now with a smaller card pool? Or was it just similar people, a few new faces, and the same sort of tournament?
I think more or less you could say that. Remco, what do you think?
To be honest, I think most of the old guard, like the 1.0 players, were there.
Yes.
Still were really looking forward to Sunday playing 1.0. And yes, some of them did well in the 2.0. A lot of them also did not.
Yeah,
I'm one of those. So, yeah, we had a great tournament, a 2.0 main event. The Melee was a blast. And also we did a 2.0 draft on first evening, which also was really fun.
Yeah, but there might have been other reasons as well why the first edition players did not so well in the Joust and Melee this year. Because, each year, when you're here for 2, 3, 4 years, you become more part of the community each year, and that means more partying and so on.
Yeah, it's harder to refuse drinks when you know everyone, right?
Yes.
I mean, one thing that we noticed as spectators from afar that was different this year is that there was an online tournament software that was used so we could follow along live. I don't know if that was Yannick specifically who pushed for that, or if that came from, you know, last minute, but being able to follow along on the jousting pavilion was extremely fun for us, who were specifically cheering for some players.
Yeah. Well, we decided it on spot, yeah, but I think it was a good decision.
Yeah, I think that was a good choice to do. I tried to ask Yannick which software he would use, and I backed him to use Pavilion, so everybody could at least follow it for those who were not here.
By the way, the creator of this Chelsea Pavilion was also a player at Schalke, Peter. He was there, and it was great to have him there. Also good for him, probably. Could get some feedback with a big player field.
Yeah, certainly. And for me, it was great because I've got import to the annals from the Justin Pavilion. So I hit a single button and all of the annals are updated with Stalic, which is much more fun than manually entering 286 results.
Yeah.
So there's big news that came out a few days after Stalic about the European Championship.
Yeah.
Actually happening in Birmingham next year. My first instinct was that this wouldn't really affect Stalic at all. That Stalic would continue. It's a community-run event that has lived for years without official status. Gaining official status was nice, but it doesn't need that to continue. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. We have not yet talked among the organizers team, but I dare say you're quite close.
Now, I think the organizing committee and all of you working on this deserve massive praise. This community-run effort that's happened over years and years and has just kept improving, and everybody comes away with glowing reviews. But for a change, I'm gonna maybe put the screws to you guys just a little bit, because this year I wrote three articles heavily criticizing FFG's organized play. These "What Are You Smoking?" articles. And I feel like it would be remiss if I didn't at least ask a few questions about things that might have caused me to raise a similar eyebrow.
Okay.
You know, of the things I've heard, most of them have been great. The complaints I heard, one person said, damn it, the beer ran out at 6 a.m. Running out at 6 a.m. the next day is not really a huge issue.
Well, actually, the beer never ran out. But we had several sorts of beer, and the one that was still in the fridge wasn't liked, though. But there was still beer.
There's still beer, I
see. Like, yes. Well, one can argue if you can call this a beer, whatever.
Oh, you mean it was an American thing?
No.
No? Oh, okay. So the first organizational one that really, really surprised me is I've been told that the Melee finals were timed and that they ended on that round without an additional round and went to tiebreaker. And this is something that really causes me to raise an eyebrow. So I'd love to hear the thought process behind that and whether that's something that might change in the future.
Remco, would you like to start?
I think by the time the Melee finals started, I was already sleeping. So I don't know what happened exactly at that point. I don't know if Wolfgang was there at that time as well, because I know that the head judge was there, and I think Helmut was there as well. But
okay, so
now, to be fair, I'm not if it was announced beforehand that that's the format that was going with, I'm fine with adhering to it, and that's not the criticism I would make. But if that was the case, it seems like even an odd decision. And one that might change going forward.
No. It was announced. The players knew about it.
Okay.
And, of course, there's a history. We had Melee games, I think 2 years ago. It was not timed, and it took more than 4 hours. So we had some bad experiences with untimed finals, also for Joust. That's why it was decided to have timed finals this year. But honestly, when I was there till the end, and I didn't feel good about how it ended. I also didn't like it. Three players at 12 power, and it was decided by counting cards. That's, not how it should be, definitely. I really hoped players know it's a timed final, so they would play faster. I think it ended after three plots.
Yeah, that's tricky. It's also people do slow down as they get later in the day.
Yes.
And drink more, as some of them were saying. They didn't know what their cards did anymore.
They should have given them more time. Still timed, but more time. Don't like untimed finals. For one very reason, players will slow down heavily, and it's not fun to watch games. I also think it's not fun for some players, because some want to play fast, or at the a decent speed at least. Well, so, difficult.
Yeah, there certainly is the argument, and I follow it, that that part of tournament prep is being able to play within tournament time limits. You know, if you're going to time, that's because you're not playing the game in the format that you're playing in the tournament. You've got to be ready for the Swiss rounds, for the cut. You've got to be ready for the time. But, of course, it feels like, you know, that failure to reach that satisfying climax, if we want to stretch the English language a little bit, is a little disappointing. I mean, the kind of things that have been done in the past have, for instance, been to have a timed round, but when the time ends, allow one more round of plots and so one more round to the game, which then puts a clock on that, but it's not an indefinite clock. But it doesn't always resolve the solution either. You might wind up at the next turn with everybody.
The reasoning also was, you know, people prepare for a tournament where a melee game lasts 90 hours. So why should it be different in the finals? It's still the same game. People are prepared to play a game of melee within 90 hours.
90 minutes, hopefully.
Okay.
I understand that. Okay, and the other then, I can definitely see the logistical reasons. You guys had several people undefeated at the end of Swiss. You only did 7 Swiss rounds, and you know I can definitely see that. But it seems that FFG published a number of different formats that could be used for tournaments of this size. Like for instance, having your 7 rounds of Swiss and then saying the top, everyone with a 5-2 record or better gets to play the next day for another few Swiss rounds and then the cut. Well, you guys still went, given that there were new formats available in the FFG tournament rules for how to handle these larger tournaments and how to break them up, it does seem weird to do it all in one day still. So I'm wondering if you guys have some thoughts about that.
Well, to be honest, not very much. it was decided before we started the registration process to have this format, mostly because we still wanted to have melee on Friday and we wanted to have the team event on Sunday. If we make a 2 days event, one of these two would have been dropped. That would have been the option. I'm not sure what will happen next year. We will certainly discuss it.
But one of the arguments that I've heard, and this may be unfair because the European team championships have been hugely supportive. The Greeks have put a tremendous effort into it, and it's been a lot of fun to have that format inaugurated at Stalik. But the sort of basic argument goes something along the lines of, if your main event, which in this case seems to be the joust and the melee, the card design things, are being affected by the side events, that's a priority thing. Especially, I don't know, as someone who gets to watch it afterwards, you know, they'll have recorded it this year. It's you always want to be able to see players at their best when you get that recording and you get to watch the match, and that's what you hope for in a final, and that's harder to get at 4 in the morning.
I don't know, actually. We should ask the players who have been playing, because ask Helmut last year.
Now, unfortunately, the remainder of this recording, about 10 minutes, was lost for some really weird issues. Just the program actually recorded the last 20 minutes twice, and I really can't make sense of it. I'll quickly go over some of the things that we went. I am sorry to both Wolfgang and Remco for losing that aspect of the recording. Normally we have backups, but I don't have backup hosts today. So we continued to discuss the joust timing a little bit, and there's talk of changing things within the organizing committee next year. It's certainly going to be discussed. We had a discussion about the deck check policy, because it appears that there were a couple of instances where that was handled. If a deck list did not specify which version of a character or did not exactly match the deck of the person in the cut, that person was forced to have cards turned upside down. And in one case, they submitted the wrong deck list, and their punishment was to randomly flip three cards upside down, which, you know, seems a little arbitrary and is not the newest policy in the tournament rules, where if a deck list is inaccurate, then the TO should make it up to date. And if they think that it was done to gain an unfair advantage, then they should take punitive action. It seems like this was done under the old rules rather than new rules. Wolfgang and Remco couldn't comment specifically about that. They're not in charge of the judging team. So that's something that we'll have to pester Kusin and Yannick and some of the organizers and Helmut, perhaps. I asked a little bit about what was going to be different next year. They said they've already got the castle booked. I think for the next 2 years, I may have misinterpreted that or be misremembering. The road to Stalic is going to change a little bit. There are going to be two new legs, one in Scotland and one in Bulgaria and Sofia. The dates are already settled for those, so add them to your calendar. And I closed off, as I've closed off most of these segments, asking people what they'll remember Stalic 2016 for. Remco mentioned definitely the community and also a particular event that happened on Sunday. We'll be touching on that later in a recording about the European Team Championship, so I won't go into detail there. And Wolfgang says he'll remember it for actually playing some Thrones. Helmut insisted, and he hasn't done this in a while, and this was a Stalic where he played some Thrones. So that's what he'll remember it for. Well, I will cast my mind back before beginning this interview to a Gen Con not all that long ago, in 2015, where a man came up to me looking for help with a deck, and eventually I found someone nearby who had an extra Martell Aloof and Apart deck, and that man was Luis. Was that your first Gen Con?
Yes, it was my first Gen Con.
And your first, I mean, there wasn't much Thrones in Brazil at the time. Well, I mean, the game was just going into print in Portuguese, wasn't it?
Yes, and we only had the first two cycles, and we didn't play a lot. But since I was going to Gen Con, and I loved the game already, I said, why not play those tournaments? And then you helped me and came to me and said, oh, Francisco might have another deck or something like that, and you put me in connection with him. And then he handed me this deck, this Aloof and Apart deck, which was a really good deck, really good and really straightforward as well. And it was exactly what I needed to go and play Gen Con. And yeah, it was good. I ended up 4-2 in Gen Con, and I think that's my most impressive record so far. It's really very hard to beat that because I didn't know the card pool, I didn't know a lot about the game.
Well, that was just on the verge of the 2.0 launch, right?
Yes, and I was already with the ticket to play the Kingslayer tournament that was happening on Saturday.
Before we check in on your amazing successes, I'd like to hear if you've managed to find local players then for the second edition and if there's been some Brazilian meta forming now that it's an easier entry.
No, not actually. We have a small group, the same that used to play 1.0, and we only play Melee, and we have a monthly Melee League, which is super cool. But it's really hard to find the cards. No one has access to them. We have to import from abroad, which makes them very expensive. A lot of people use proxies. Sometimes they share like a core set and the chapter packs, and everyone gets like two houses. Of course, they lend each other cards, but mainly they do that. In a small group, in like 19 players that play the league and 10 active, but it's only Melee, which is good, I think.
It's certainly, I'm sure it only being Melee has something to do with the reason that we brought you in. It clearly has worked for you because you are now the only, well, first of all, you were the first person from outside of Europe to place at a final table at Stalic ever. You played at that final table in the Melee. It was 163 people, an absolutely enormous Melee, and you actually won it. It was, from the sounds of it, you won it, and you were probably drunker than I have ever been. At least at the start of it, you were messaging us. But even before that, 2 days before the Melee, you sent Beyond the Wall a message saying, I don't know what I'm going to play. Can you help me? And I didn't see the message until I saw that you were at the final table of the tournament. So you clearly didn't need our help. You clearly constructed a deck that is going to work very well for you throughout the day. So maybe we can start with the ambiance of the tournament, the idea of going to Stalic, what sent you to Stalic, Why the other end of the world for some thrones?
Well, it's Talix supposed to be the greatest one about them all, doesn't it? So I went in February to Batalha. I had an opportunity to go. I had a friend living in Madrid, so that made the trip easier. And I met all the Europe people, and they were awesome. I mean, Gen Con was really, really nice, and I met a lot of nice people. But the European community, they really embraced me, and I had an amazing time in Madrid. Thrones-wise, of course, because it's a strong meta, and also socializing with everyone, which was so cool. And I said, I want to go to a tournament in Europe again. And then I started researching, and I saw prices of tickets, and as far as I know, going to Starlet is much cheaper than going to the United States in August or July, the date of Gen Con. So I decided to go, and I saved some money, and I bought my ticket, and I went there.
And how did it live up to your expectations? I mean,
it's ridiculous. It's much better than I could expect. Everybody has to go. Even the food is good. I mean, you are in a hostel, which is a castle in the middle of Germany. You don't expect the food to be good, but the food is good. And everybody's so friendly. All the pro players, people that was scared even to talk, like Alex Trigg, he's a gentleman, and he took me around. He taught me a lot of stuff. We drank together, and all the people from England, they are so nice. Bambi's so nice. I met him in Batalha, but we spent a lot of time together. This time we played in, I think, 3 times this tournament, which was good, and all of them were really nice. It's hard for me to say. I want to go back. That's one thing that I know. I want to go back.
So you were there for the whole event, for obviously if you're going to travel from that far, for Friday, for Saturday, for Sunday, for the complete thing.
Yes.
And in Melee, you chose to take a Lannister deck. This is not necessarily, I mean, it was Lannister Banner of the Rose, but a large part of what we'd seen at Gen Con was a huge prevalence of Stark in various forms. And while the Lanny box did give a few tools for Melee, it wasn't that many. So what drove you to play that deck?
Well, New Cersei is really powerful, and that was the main reason. I thought Banning Arde would be better because it's melee. You have to have rush and grab power really quickly. It's still very hard to find a character better than Marjorie for melee. It's hard for me to think of one. She's really, really good. She solved so many problems.
I have seen, obviously, Cersei is a phenomenal character for that. But in all the melees we've played with her so far, she's been the first character to get milked.
No, I overcome that. I know how to play with her now. You don't trigger her.
You don't trigger her.
You don't. It's one of my best deals that I've been made in the whole day when I was playing it.
I love this. You just
say, okay, I know that you are like terrifying of the Cersei. You saw probably in your other table, but let's just make a deal. I won't trigger her for this round. How do you say? Okay, makes sense. And I was doing that deal every single game.
And then you flip heads on spikes and you're boom, 3 power.
No, yeah, well, I could do that. I won one turn in head on spikes in my defense, but it was on other people's heads on spike. I don't know. It was very odd table. Part of my deal was not triggering her. And if the person would like push that and said, oh, you said you won't trigger her, don't trigger her now. I would just, okay, but we didn't say about this hound. How about just one power? And then, one power is okay. We could come with a reasonable answer. and
you
yeah.
managed to avoid her getting milked or nightmared at every turn. Well, I love that, actually.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic. And it speaks to, yeah, you know.
It was one of my plays.
Yeah, you keep saying, oh, I learned this from these other people and so on. But I was right at the beginning. You have things to teach us here. You have things to teach us. You also have quite a few adjustments to your deck that definitely make it a melee deck. The Dragon's Tales, which apparently were quite popular throughout the tournament. And then, you know, Marjorie is a fantastic joust card as well, but gives you that flexibility of offering people other boosts or making the challenges other people make matter in the ways that help you the most.
Yes.
So I know that one of the things that some people complain about in first edition or in second edition is that we don't specifically have the trading plots. We don't specifically have some of those elements.
I hated those.
So did I. So how do you feel about the interactivity of the deck with other players, or even just the melee game in general, the way that players are interacting with one another through Dragon's Tales, through Marjorie's, through the heads on spikes and things
yeah,
like that?
the cards that allow you to interact are definitely growing. I see a good place for it in the future, but you cannot compare it to first edition still. But as you said, the trading plots, they were like ridiculous bad because it was silly. You could like choose any deck and put a card in there and you can guarantee that you start the game with it. So that was not fun for deck building. You built a whole deck around an attachment or a location or a character and was easy. You wouldn't lose anything by to search for the card and put in your hand in the first turn because everybody was doing the same. It was quite a silly for me. And I like that they don't exist anymore, but I miss things like Condemned by the Realm, for instance, that you choose an option to kill a character, which is really cool for melee because you could make a deal with that. And you can kill a strong character for someone that's ahead of you and change the game. And things like that I really miss.
Mm-hmm. So the deck obviously performed very well for you. I believe there were 4 Swiss rounds, is that right?
It was 4 Swiss, then two games in the cut. I lost my first Swiss round terribly. And I had to go on a winning strike to be there.
So what kind of decks did you see? Did you see any big surprises, things that you weren't expecting?
No.
And so the field was what, mostly Starks, some Greyjoy, and a lot of...
A lot of Targaryen and Starks. I was expecting a lot of Starks. I was expecting a lot of Ward as well, because it's such an easy way to win on marshalling, you know? And Starks has a lot of ways of doing that. The Stark Burn of the Lion deck that you can put like River Run, Boys King, sometimes even Yupeng, you kill a card, you can turn Blackfish on first marshalling phase and they can win first turn. And if you let them go to the second marshalling phase, they could do even more stuff and ward your character. For instance, like Knights of the Summer, I didn't want them in my deck because I was worried about ward. And also I saw a lot of Targaryen. But, well, there wasn't any answer for me to do against Targaryen. I could just try to hit her hand so they couldn't steal Baris and Selmy in one game that ended up working really well because Baris and Selmy is really powerful. He can stand in every challenge if you let them.
Actually, that's a great thing because I haven't latched on to using the Lanny box in melee yet, so I hadn't looked at Baris in the point of view of melee, and I did see a couple of lists running him. What were those lists doing to make Barristan useful for gaining power, for instance? Was it just the fact that he could participate in multiple challenges?
Yes, and that was it's interesting that you say that, because that's one of the best advice I got. And do you know who I got them from?
I have a feeling that if I say something, it will either come off as incredibly egotistical, I'm going to say someone called Alex.
Yes, exactly that person. And, well, in the beginning of this year, you were saying that how important it is to have cards to participate in every challenge and get those challenges through. And that is much more important than, like, having a piece of your toolbox to make something happen. Like, just participating in challenges is really important. The Martell deck who got in the final with me, that Wedge is piloting, was just a deck full of wins. They would participate in any challenge. They wouldn't let any challenge unopposed. And if you go big on them, they could just punish you with Sunspear or Gastengray or something like that. And they didn't have any tricks, actually. Just like small dudes participating in every single challenger. And Wedge took it to the final.
I think that the main reason that that's much truer than it was in first edition, and I've said it on the cast as well, is the ability to rival two players and poke through those unopposed challenges on the board. You know, if you're not making your 3 challenges on a turn, you are slowing yourself down.
Exactly. And this is also a really big change. I don't know if a lot of people realize that. Of course, all the experts, they know. But you don't. I mean, if you're looking for like a long run and a long tournament, you don't get the Queen Regis title. You just don't get it. It's awful. It's so much worse than the other ones. I it's really hard for me to see a reason to get it. Maybe only if you are like first player in the third round, you know, really close to finish and get into 15 power so you can attack anyone. But that's the only reason I can see. And I saw players getting it and it wasn't a good deal for them the whole tournament.
I certainly have found it to be less useful than the redirect was in first edition. except as a way to allow people to bypass support structures.
Yeah.
So by getting it, you can allow someone to attack someone that you need them to attack, and that can be quite useful, which is fun. Wanted to double check, so you mentioned some of the finalist decks. You mentioned Wedge's deck was very much a Martell. There were what was Kostas from Scotland primarily doing with his Targrows?
Well, it was Dothraki Targrows with knights, knights and Danny, knights, Danny and Dragon. Always leaving one gold on the plot, using Drakkaris to get unopposed or to punish people attacking him. And I think probably it's if I would go to the tournament again, I would go Targrows.
Okay. And then Mateusz from Poland, he was playing
also a really strong deck, Starklani with Boy King. He had actually you playing to get make sure he will get more power on marshalling the minstrels and riverruns, and this deck is so powerful. But it's too scary. That's why I would pick Targ instead of the Stark one. It's too powerful.
All right, let's maybe share some of the storied matchups. There must have been some moments where it all came through, and let's not talk about the final quite yet, because I know
there's some very special things
that happened in the final. but leading up to the final, you said you lost your first game quite badly. You knew you had to keep winning for that. Were there any, you know, big moments in the games that allowed you to do that?
Yes. Well, all the tables are really hard, especially my first one. In the first table that I lost, I set up the mountain and a knighted. As you know, mountain is already a knight. So it was just for the increasing my card draw. And first turn, we all took
turns. It's for an 11 strength, Gregor.
Yeah. Because 10 isn't enough, right? and first turn, we all took a 3 claim trial by combat, Cersei attack, and we lost 3 characters, but they all had dupes, and Tamas had Ira, and the Greyjoy player had Iron Mind, Risen from the Sea, and end up with no table at all. And that was really hard for me, my first game. So that was a funny story. But in the same game, since I set up in the mountain and nobody marched, I said, okay, it's okay, nobody plays march, which is fine, it's melee. And then in the third turn, Tamas went played Varys. And then in the fourth plot, we went to the fourth plot, the two players flipped march to the wall. So they end up, they did have march to the wall in their deck, and they just didn't want to punish me in the setup, which was kind of nice. I felt like, okay, thank you guys.
Well, there's the thank you guys aspect of it, but there's also the aspect that if you're going to flip, you know, if you're going to set someone back that far to the point where they have zero characters, you need to be sure that you are the one who can capitalize on that opening better than anybody else.
Yes.
Setting a player back is, especially to the point where they're not in the game and then they become unpredictable and, you know, they're no longer playing to win, is a very dangerous thing to do. And in fact, one of the general tenets of melee is make sure that nobody gets too far ahead and nobody falls too far behind.
Yes.
Except obviously you want to go far ahead.
but it was a strange situation, because I tried to explain to the person that went with against me with the 3 claim trial by combat what would happen. I said, you don't do that in melee. You need everybody to be kind of leveraged, and you were the only one who should be ahead. You don't eliminate a player from the game. But he ended up winning the table. So everything that I said just...
Well, he was sure that he was the one who was going to be better placed at the end of that, I guess.
Well, and so I couldn't say anything, because he won the table anyways. But then in the end... in the tournament, after I won, I said to him, so now can you understand what I said in the first table that we played? I know you won the table, but it's really important. You don't eliminate the player from the game. It's more logical. Makes you, you control better your possibilities if you have more people playing.
Yeah, I agree. So that, yeah, Claim 3 Trial by Combat, certainly with the Master of Whispers title, is a rough pill to swallow. Maybe I guess we can touch on the final now.
Okay.
I've talked to the organizers and had an interview with them, and I've talked a little bit about this. I do want to check. Did you guys know at the beginning of the tournament that the final was going to be timed?
I had no idea. But we checked in the middle of the game.
in the middle. So you didn't know until halfway through the final itself.
No, I didn't know. I don't know about the other people.
Okay.
But I had to play a Dochella in the final. I'm mentioning wheel archetypes. I had to go because I was far behind as well. So I had to call some chaos and see to see what happens, because I had a terrible setup and my hand wasn't helping as well. So make sure to cause some trouble to everyone. That's how I was playing the game. But in the middle of the game, they said, okay, it's going to time. And people kept playing normally.
So, I mean, there are reasons to have a timed final, and there are good reasons not to. And, you know, obviously, everyone at that final table had won many games that day and had 5 out of 8 factions at that table, right?
Yes, 5 out of 8.
So all of these are great things for the game. Obviously, the way that game ended, and for those of you who don't know, there was a 3-way tie for 12th, and then it came down to card count. You know, I think that's unfortunate. I don't think it speaks badly of any of the players, and it doesn't speak badly of your win. That's the format that people were playing. But it is less of a satisfying final, right?
I don't really feel like that, Alex. I didn't want to go to time, but since there was 3 players tied on 12, sorry, it was on the 3rd turn, it shows how close the game was and how hard the match was going, how hard the match was happening. It was a really hard game, and that shows a little bit of it. It, of course, we don't want to end in time, but it tells the story of the game, actually. Everybody had a chance to win, and it wasn't one of those quick melee games. And in the final, the game was totally different. It was a very strategic game with everybody was making sure no one was winning, which is kind of different and cool in a way.
It's not just that. I mean, there are two approaches to that. You know, you want to see a final come to a satisfying conclusion. The perfect final is one that is hard fought, that players had chances, that you get to watch skilled, fresh players who aren't on like hour 11 of their day. But that's sort of what your ideal is, you know, for the best players in the world playing their best, and then someone wins. And so there's two arguments to this, and I'm okay with either. One being that you want to let the final be on time to allow skill over maximum periods of time, and the other being that part of a tournament is winning in time. That's a skill you need to learn in all of the Swiss rounds and things like that. So you do have to factor in, and you do need to learn to play within the time limit to make a tournament. And I'm okay with that. What worries me a little bit more about this particular instance is, as you said, you didn't know until halfway through the final that it was timed. And that's what bothers me about this one. It's not that it was timed. I think you can justify that if you make it clear beforehand. But that it wasn't timed, I think that can be justified too. It's that you didn't know until halfway through.
But in our defense, Alex, it's so rare that a melee game 2.0 will go to time, you know? It's
it's not that rare for finals, because if you look at the last 3 Worlds finals, they've certainly been long games.
Yes, I know. It makes sense, of course, not for finals, but I didn't know that I was going to be in the finals, so I never asked it, and all the games were so quick.
None of this is intended to detract from your win, because
no, it's okay.
Set up for the tournament and fantastic time.
It was a funny in the final. You know, in melee, you don't want to go first, right? Especially in the first round, because you don't get to steal power from anyone. But I was so with such a bad start. I had Duper Knight of Flowers and a location, Castle Rock, that allows you to do 2 intrigue challenges. And I had nothing on my hand. And everybody has a really great setup. And I opened with Varus Riddle against Mateus, the Stark player, Summer Harvest. And one of my deals with Costas, that one initiative, was let me be first player. And why do you want to be first player? I just want to make sure he gets your gold. Let's pick this plot right. Of course, Mateus got really cross with me because he didn't see the point of that. But I was so far behind. I have to push somebody to go bad with me, and to
make you less of a target.
Yes, exactly. I didn't want to be the only one behind, you know. So I was really worried about that. And so my deal was, let me be first player in a melee table. You don't want that, especially in the first round.
Mm-hmm. But it worked out for you. Again, more great strategic plays.
Well,
for Stalic, both the Joust and the Melee were awarded card designs. You won a card design out of this. You get to make a good card. You have, I mean, this is a year into playing Game of Thrones, basically, a little over a year. A year and 3 months into playing Game of Thrones. And then, you know, you play Melee locally, you get very good at it, you have the strategic tips, and you play it at Stalic and you rise to the top. Do you have any ideas for that card design?
That's such a silly question. Of course I don't have an idea. I never thought about the designing a card before. I know one thing that I want to do, which is, well, and I already talked to the guys. I want to invite Costas and Wedge, the two guys that went with 12 power with me in the final table, to help. And they said they would, so it makes me very happy. So we can now design a card together. I don't know if it's possible, and Fund of the Fight but I don't think they can avoid that. So my name will be on the card, I think. I would love them to participate and help me on this one. That's the only thing that I know. But, well, so, if I can choose, I can make something OP, of course. But, yeah, and that's the only thing that I know. Apart from that, well, it would be a card.
Will it be a card that works well in Melee?
Well, people are saying that, but I don't know. It could be a good card for Joust. I love Joust as well.
But not a good card for Draft, then.
Well, I love Draft. I went third on Draft on Stalic. Oh,
really?
Yes. I was third place, which was really cool. I think it was 24 people tournament on Thursday. Mostly people were more, it was more interesting in drink, but few of us went to play Draft. And it was great tournament. Great format. Probably is my favorite. I don't know.
Excellent. Did you get a chance to get, or you'll have to find a way to bring some draft packs back to your local meta?
Yeah, I'll just have to import them, travel abroad and bring them to, but it's hard here. It's impossible to convince people to play Joust with me, you know? I don't know what to do.
That's okay. The Melee has clearly paid off, so you can't complain too much.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if the Draft Melee would work. It's hard.
It probably is very hard. I don't know if I would play Draft in Melee. It's really been designed.
And if you ever play Draft, go for Core in Halfhand, please.
If you ever play Joust, go for Core in Halfhand.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But can you imagine that in Draft? It's
yes, in Draft, it looks insane. Excellent. Well, I'm so glad to hear of a glowing, really nice experience had at Stalic from someone not from the European community, you know, welcomed with open arms. I'm so glad to hear that you did well. Pleasure to have met you at Gen Con, and little did I know that I'd be, you know, talking to someone else with a card design a year later after helping them find a deck for their Gen Con.
Yeah, I have to props Patrick Haynes and Francisco from Chile. They all helped me to choose the deck. I have to mention that. It's important because you guys weren't there to answer my message.
I didn't. Yeah, that's right. It really is.
And I always ask for help. No. Always.
Well, that's excellent. And that's a good way to keep ties across the entire community as well, to just bounce ideas off and share ideas with people across the world.
Yeah.
So I have one question that I've been asking everyone posing a Stalic interview. With you, maybe the answer may be more obvious, but maybe not. What is it that you'll remember Stalic 2016 for? What was Stalic 2016 for you?
It's all about definitely being part of the community, but like, really being part of the community. But before Stalic, I was just the people admiring the community and how good it was. But now I feel part of it. So that was the biggest picture for me.
Well, that's a beautiful sentiment. Thank you so much, Luis.
Okay, of course. It was an honor again. I cannot believe that I'm beyond the wall. It's so cool.
We're joined here today by two Beyond the Wall veterans. You both appeared in episodes before. One of you appeared in a Stalic episode before. The finalists of the largest Joust tournament ever held. We have Florian Mass, and I've called him this before, the best player never to have won a major tournament. That's clearly changed. He popularized a Stark No Agenda deck way back in first edition called Grand Theft Location, a phenomenal deck. He won a big Octagon League tournament back then. Yanis, who, if you played in the Octagon League tournaments as well, you recognize he's won the last two, I believe. So two phenomenal players. And apparently, Florian is contaminating us all and we're all sick. Would you care to explain?
No statement.
I'm going to start off with a few details about the tournament. It was a 7 rounds, top 32, which is a bit weird. That left 3 undefeateds. Moving to the castle in between meant that the final happened. What time did the final happen?
Like 3 a.m., I believe.
I think it was like 3:30 or something to the start.
At some point, you just lose track of time.
Yeah, I didn't care. I mean, I was already getting more awake already again. So.
Well, that seems to be the thing. I mean, this would be something I would object to academically. And then every time I ask the finalists, like last year with Helmut and Jesus, they're like, oh, no, it's no problem. At that point, you're running on adrenaline and it's fine. But I'm not sure it is fine. I know that at least, Florian, you mentioned you had a couple of games in the cut where exhaustion definitely played a role in your victory. And I don't know if that was your experience as well, Yanis?
In a way, it played a role because I think I took it way better than most of my opponents, because most of my opponents seemed tired while I didn't feel tired at all. So I guess it gives an advantage to people who are used to sometimes just play games all night. So, I mean, I might be guilty at that.
And so what are your thoughts about that format then? Were you happy with this, or were there some changes you'd make going forward next year? If you were in charge.
I mean, if I were in charge, we'd be playing 7 rounds or 8 rounds of Swiss, and then we'd call it a day and return for the cut next day. But, I mean, you also have the team event, and you kind of have to handle that, and then you have to make compromises. But I still think that it's not a good thing to play the entire event in one day, or, well, not in one day, but in one sitting.
Yeah, I think it would be better to cut it into two days, and then maybe it would be even possible to do like the finals or even the semifinals in a best of three instead of best of one, because I think it's kind of stupid to just lay after such a long tourney to lay it on only one game. I mean, I obviously say that because I lost the final, but
well, this is something that has actually been implemented this year in the Road to Stalik in a couple of the tournaments. Notably, Varberg Morgulis had a best of three finals. And they happened to be streamed finals, and we all got a chance to watch them. They were recorded. There was excellent commentary, which made the whole thing feel a bit more like an event, those last three matches.
Yeah.
I mean, just to come back to that one point concerning play duration, you're really doing a disservice to the game by having such a long tournament, because the games, at the end, when everyone is really tired, the game quality just deteriorates immensely. You have players that are nationals winner that just play complete garbage. And that's really not in the spirit of the game, I feel, when the largest tournament around is decided by, well, who makes the less stupid mistakes?
Well, I think that's a reasonable way to put it. So aside from then training your endurance, what did you guys do in preparation for Stalik, both in deck choice and your expectations for the meta?
First of all, I played a lot. Like, 2 months before Stalik, I had this idea of playing Baratheon Sun, the deck I later took. Originally, I built a deck just to annoy people in Octagon and make a deck that is as unpleasant to play again as possible. And then I realized it's really strong. And then I started to play it, like, a lot and in very long sessions, like 7 or 8 hours in a session on Octagon, deep into the night, just to basically simulate the Stalik experience, which was kind of annoying at some time, because when you're sitting there at 4 o'clock in the morning and wait for a game and nobody joins, and you think, why am I even doing this? And but on the other hand, it was kind of funny to prepare that intensely. And then I switched out. I pretty early focused on that deck, and then I decided I want to take it, and then I wanted to make it as good as possible. And I liked the idea of not bringing any of the factions anyone thought would be superior, like Lannister or Stark or Targaryen or whatever. Just build something nobody else plays and see how far I can get with it. I mean, that was basically the goal.
Well, the nobody else played didn't really work out, because in the month or so leading up to Stalik, Varus started to be the best performing faction in the annals.
Yeah, I realized that like 1 week before the tournament, I looked into the annals and thought, crap, especially since my deck is pretty weak against Barra dominance. So I thought, hopefully nobody else looks at this. And then you published that article, and I thought, oh my god, now people will play Barra. But it worked out in the end, I guess. But what I did accomplish is I was the only one in the whole tourney of Stalik that played the faction agenda combo. So I was the only one playing Barra Sun. So at least that worked out.
And Florian, what did you do in preparation, and why did you settle on Stark?
Well, my preparation this year was actually rather unceremonious. Usually, well, let's just call it, I used to also play a lot before Starlink and just test for 1 month straight without any breaks. But recently, my life has caught up with me, so this time I had to choose a more lenient approach. And so I just chose a deck that I thought was good in stock, like 1 month or 1.5 months before the tourney. And I just played that, and I tried to come up with the best list possible. And that takes much less time than really trying to figure out the meta and getting the best deck possible, to just have one deck and focus on that. Yeah, it was less time-consuming, and it was also very rewarding to approach the tournament in that manner for once. So that was my preparation.
So I'll maybe dig into each of your lists in turn, starting with yours, Florian. There do seem to be some choices that I'm sure you must have tried out or opted in and out of. For instance, there's no Wildfire in your deck. There's only two different Direwolves for a time for Wolves. There's only one ward. Are these things that you played around with, and how did you settle on that particular combination?
A lot of testing went into the list, that's for sure. And not only my own testing. It's basically the list that won Gen Con and that Nosh gratefully provided me with.
That won Gen Con? No, Landy Dragon won Gen Con.
I think US Nationals was one.
Oh, yeah, Nationals.
Okay, yes.
I still think that's the same all the
Origins.
Time.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, that list. This is actually a great story. Darknosh provided me with the list, and it was pretty much the list I ended up with. A few minor changes. And then I was like, yeah, no, screw this. I want to be my own player. I want to have fun. I want to build my own deck and have my own touch in this build. I changed things that I thought were sort of uncreative, and started to build my own list. And then I started playing with the list, and over 10 or 15 games, I came closer and closer to John's list again, and was kind of disheartening to go from my creative product that had like Crypts of Winterfell and all this janky stuff that was amazing to John's streamlined list again. And in the streamlining process, we found that some card choices were necessary, but also that you didn't want to overcommit on them. So you have the one ward because you never really want to draw two of them. That's just not something you can play in one game. And then you have like the three Direwolves because you can't really afford more deck slots for the Direwolves, but the package is so important. I cannot stress this enough. Like, the two Direwolves, like the two Summer and the Grey Wind, plus the tutoring plot, is probably, if they had to choose one element of the deck that is most important for this deck to work, it's probably that one.
Yeah, I mean, Grey Wind won me the final, pretty much. I mean,
yeah, Grey Wind won me the final.
Having no attachments and being able to eat your occasional start character certainly helps.
Yeah.
He didn't eat anything, he intimidated. Always a guy so he could win a ball, so I didn't draw cards. That was the problem.
A lot of choices that are sort of on the edge where I just commit enough to the strategy that it works, but I don't overcommit to it, and therefore get the powerful interactions while still having a lot of like the basic meat of the deck that is just strong and powerful and consistent. So that's basically the core idea.
And you didn't find you needed Wildfire?
Oh, Wildfire was actually the last thing I took out, like 2 days before the tournament. I had a talk with one of my meta mates, and he too was playing Stark. And he said, in all of his games on Octagon, he's never used Wildfire once for great effect. And then JC was also pretty down on it. So I thought, well, I usually don't have a great opening plot. I have to do awkward openings like trading, even if I don't want to give my opponent the gold. And then I talked to Darknosh, and he said, well, let's try Calm. And without testing, I included Calm, which was the best choice ever. It was like the best plot all day.
Almost done poking at your deck. I'm somewhat saddened by the lack of Osha, one of my favorite favorite characters, but I'm heartened by the Area's Gifts, which are among my favorite cards to include in a Stark list nowadays. I have them in a Lord of the Crossing Rush deck as well as a fealty closer to...
Wasn't actually that great on that day because I didn't play against a lot of Night's Watch. It's really only good against Night's Watch and the occasional Martell.
And the occasional Barasun, presumably. I mean, I don't know if you drew them, but...
Yeah, against Janus, they would have won me the game at any point if I had drawn them. But alas, I didn't.
I think you had won very early, didn't you?
I can't remember either, so might be true.
So the very last point that I want to do is pick apart that. I mean, Nate French has called Stark the police of the metagame. Does that fit, and is that making it an inherently stabler choice for a big tournament where you don't necessarily want to... You said you didn't have time to figure out the meta. Is that where Stark fits, or is that just coincidence? Stark was the one you wanted to play.
This is incredibly mundane, but I just like Stark.
Hey, your history is with Stark. You know, your Grand Theft Location, one of the best decks of first edition for a long period of time. That was Stark.
Although I have to say that I'm not that into Stark. Like my results kind of seem to indicate that Stark is really my main faction, but I don't really think that I have a main faction. But I just liked what Stark was doing.
What you mean is you're just failing to accept the fact that you're a Stark loyalist.
Well, I can't deny the evidence. At this point, you probably could and should classify me as a Stark loyalist. I'm just... I guess I have... I'm proud of it. Yay.
All right.
Stark rules.
So let's have a look and start picking apart a little bit some of the choices going into Janus' deck. And I think the first thing that really jumped out at me looking at this list, especially in comparison to a similar list that I had, is that you have only two sources of acceleration in the deck, Renown or Dominance Tech or otherwise. You have a Robert and you have a Knight of the Sun. And that's it. Can you walk me through that process?
Yeah, to be honest... I'm a control player at heart, and for me, Renown is a keyword that is a non-factor for me. I don't care if a card has Renown, because if I can take over the board completely, it doesn't matter how fast my characters get power, because I will win eventually anyways. The only problem with that is time limit, but I finished all my games in time this day, which Florian didn't, I think.
That's right, a nice little jab there, but I was gonna say, yeah, you played a control deck and didn't get a single timed win.
I got a timed loss that would have been a normal win for me if somebody hadn't called time 3 minutes early and we didn't know it wasn't time yet in the last round of the Swiss, so I was a bit annoyed about that, but doesn't matter at this stage. So Robert is basically in because he's big, mainly. He can win a challenge on his own, and if he's on the offense, which he barely isn't usually, he can even kneel out another guy. And the Knight of the Sun actually is only in because he costs 4 and has no attachments, so... He is not first snowable and he's not wardable, so he just fits the slot perfectly. So, and to be honest, the Knight of the Sun, I don't think he ever had power and was there in the end of the game. So, because he usually gets wildfired away at some stage anyways. So, the deck basically wins by, after the second wildfire, usually the opponent doesn't have any characters left that have icons and are standing at the same time. So you get 3 unopposed per phase. And then you win pretty fast anyways. So that's the plan of the deck. And then you don't need Renown because it doesn't really matter. I mean.
Now there's some other neat ones. This is the first big competitive list I've seen pull out the Stone Drum, which, you know, non-limited economy, absolutely fantastic on setup. And I think you had 3 Kingdom plots yourself. I'm somewhat curious as to how often you got the trigger off an opponent's plot.
I didn't make a record, of course, but it feels like a good location because, I mean, in my testing phase, I basically made a little Excel sheet, where I just put down how often I played the Stone Drum and played a limited in the same round. Because that's the only way it is better than a Rose Road, mm-hmm. because it basically replaced the Rose Road. It's only better when I played and a limited in the same round, because if not, I could have played just the Rose Road, which is better, because it gives me a gold every single turn. And it turned out that it is often enough to make it worthwhile just because it gives the deck a bit more of an upside. And the thing is, most decks, and this one included, need the most gold in the early turns. And in the early turns, there are way more kingdoms played than in the late turns, because all the opening plots, or most of the opening plots, are kingdoms. And also all the plots that give you cards are kingdoms. And, I mean, of course, there are decks like, especially Kings of Winter, that play almost no kingdoms except for maybe one county coppers. But in most matchups, you get one or two times gold from opponent's plot while you don't have a kingdom revealed, and that makes it already good.
Okay. Sort of one of the other things is I see that despite not having a particularly high Martell count, you did include three ocean roads. Now, the reasoning is fairly obvious. You're having these attachments bouncing to hand and returning. Did that ever drive you to consider Ariane as another card that can regularly be replayed and dodge your own wildfires?
So first of all, Ocean Road is, in my opinion, the best card out of the Langley box, hand down.
I think I can agree with you.
Obviously not for fealty decks, but for decks that can run it, it's insanely good. I mean, my deck had only economy that sticks on the board, so in turn 7 or 8, it's what was not unusual for me to have 7 or 8 limiteds on the board and have a crazy economy going in comparison to my opponents who ran King's Roads, because their economy was just going away. And when it comes to Ariane, the problem is Ariane synergizes not at all with Baratheon, because pretty much all your cards that are cheap are mostly Rolo cards, but Melisandre only triggers when their cards are marshaled, not when they are put into play. So half of your cards that you could put in with Ariane, you can't really put in because it's not good. So there was not a big synergy. And also I run two Littlefingers, but putting in Littlefinger with Ariane is also bad. So
yeah, fair enough. This is one for both of you, because the community as a whole has sort of accepted this, and I haven't because I'm stubborn, stupid, or whatever. You both ran trading. Now, trading cannot be a good plot for every deck. It has to be a good plot for a deck that can better leverage the gold differential than the opponent can. So I want to hear each of your justifications, maybe starting with Yanis. Why did you run trading?
In my deck, it's pretty much one of the best plots ever, because I'm wildfaring all the time, and my opponents oftentimes didn't know that. So it's oftentimes, I open counting coppers. So first turn, I don't care what my opponent does because he can't harm me because I don't have a board anyways. Second turn, I play trading. Play cards. My opponents oftentimes played out their whole hand at that stage. And then third turn, wildfire. So what do you have from the three gold the turn before? You played out another character that died. Nothing else. So when you wildfire all the time, it doesn't matter how much gold your opponent has, because unless he has like 3-7 costers in hand, he can't really get much benefit from playing more cards because they're getting wildfired away anyways. So I think it's a great plot for that deck at least. The only downside to the plot really is the 5 reserve. It's pretty insane how much difference 5 reserve to 6 reserve does.
Especially with a deck that does have, you know, attachments bouncing to hand. And
yeah, at the red keep that draws card at the end of the phase, I mean.
So perhaps my counter argument there would be that there are decks in which they can leverage even a temporary character advantage. Specifically Stark, where even if they know the wildfire is coming, getting an extra character on the board and then using that for an additional challenge and then a sacrifice for Jon Snow or something like that can give them the tempo advantage they need to keep going. But, I mean, obviously, well, I don't know if Stark is necessarily a bad matchup for you. I think you said it isn't. But I'm always hesitant to play a trading against a Stark that can leverage that.
Well, I can first make a case for trading in my opponent's deck because I love to trade in Stark. That's amazing. It's just like you get a normal turn and then you get to play ice on top of that, which is just the icing on the cake, really.
Oh, bad pun.
Yeah, I planned that all along. I'm devious. So trading in my deck is more of a fail-safe. It's not really in there because I like to play it. It's because I need to play it. Especially against choke. Against choke, I think trading is a must. If you don't have trading, you pretty much lose all of the time because you don't have a single turn where you can play your big characters. Choke also puts pressure on you, so you can't just play a big character with a King's Road or something. You also have to play something else so your big character doesn't just immediately die. So that's what trading is for in that matchup. And then you also... What mitigates the downside of trading a little bit in other matchups, as already mentioned, can play a big character, and then you play ice, and then they can't really do a whole lot with the additional gold if they don't have a dupe for the character they were going to play with the gold they now got. So, yeah, it's not a plot that is very ideal for Stark, I would say, and I would love to play something else if there were another option, but I think it was kind of necessary to mitigate bad setups over the course of the tournament or respond to choke.
And was choke an issue? Was it highly prevalent at the tournament?
I played 2 times against Choke, and I wouldn't have won either of those games without trading, so I'm glad that I packed it in. And I want to quickly respond to that earlier jab that I that I won a lot of games on time, which is actually true. So I won 1 game on time, like really on time, and then I had 3 more games or so over the course of the day that I had not won by 15 power, but my opponent scooped because we sort of had this gentleman's agreement that we wouldn't take away points from the other player.
Or that you just didn't want your strength of schedule to suffer.
Yeah. This is something I think should be addressed in 2 manners. First of all, this is what Stark is really efficient at. You just come out of the gates and you rush for some power, you collect your power, and then you just stay on the board. It doesn't even matter what your opponent is doing. You can eat military challenges and intrigue challenges all day long with Stark. You don't even care. Because an Arya with a dupe counts for 6 military claim in this deck. Because you play Arya, you claim her 2 times. Then you play Summer, and you get her back, and you claim her another 2 times. And then if you sacrifice Summer and you play another Summer, you can have 6 claim on Arya, which is obviously absurd. And if you draw other copies of Arya, there's even more military claim. So you can just stay on the board without really investing anything and just keep pushing through those power challenges. Your opponent can never reach you. You will never win the game, but you can just sort of stay ahead. And if there's 20 minutes left on the clock, your opponent can't really win against you, which I did like 3 times the day where I was really down on board, actually. And those are games that I should have lost, but I would have lost them in 2 hours. And the game, unfortunately, only took 1. And the second manner in which I want to address this issue is it's kind of a critique of the tournament system that we have at the moment, where your opponent gets to decide whether you get 5 or 4 points, which is incredibly unfair if you think about it, because that adds another layer of randomness to the tournament, because you are at the mercy of your opponent to give you points if you win on time.
And Yanis, what did you feel about the time structure in general? I mean, you didn't bump into the time limit at all?
As I said, I had that one timed loss that wasn't a timed loss, but except of that, I mean, I had a few games that were... I was always stressed out because of it, because what my deck usually does is letting the opponent get to 11 power while I have like 1 or 2, and then he suddenly can't do any challenges anymore, and then I catch up. The problem is, if my opponent plays slow, I get into trouble. So I had, for example, in 4th round, I think that was, I played against a Targaryen player, and in turn 4, he was in power 12 to my 2. So we was up 12 to 2. After that, he didn't make a single power anymore the whole game, so it's... He stayed on 12-2 for a while because I took 1 away in the power challenge. He won dominance pretty much every turn. I won that game against him in turn 10, so we went to plot 10. If that guy just plays slow, I probably just lose the game. But he doesn't really have decisions to do because he was top decking and he didn't have any icons in the challenge phase. So he would have to waste time to make the game go slow because he doesn't have any decisions. Because if you have no characters, what are you thinking about? So... Yeah, obviously. I mean,
you're
that's the reason
about
why.
How good that Danny would look with an intrigue icon.
Yeah, and without a milk and a power icon. I mean, but that's the problem a bit. I mean, it's always bad when a system basically encourages you to slow play and waste time. And I mean, ideally we would have infinite time in each round, but that's not doable, especially not in those huge tournaments. So I'm not sure how to fix it. But I think at the moment they took away the point you get for a modified loss, they should also erase the modified win, because it's kind of stupid that there are less points given out in total when there's a mod win. So basically they should just make it, win or not win. I mean, that still gives the problem with the slow playing issue, but I have no idea how to solve that except for don't be a dick in tournaments. But
Or just yell at people who play slow and shame them. Run around with the bell yelling shame, shame.
Yeah, I had that at the tournament already. I don't need that.
Excellent. Now, there's a comment of Florian's, and I'm actually going to maybe I'll read out or misquote it, basically. Florian said something along the lines in a completely private chat, and then it's then been reposted
by
James.
Oh, God. Why is this following me?
It was reposted by James, so it's public now, but it's not my fault. It's James's. And you said that throughout the course of the day, you probably had four excellent, really good strategic games, and then some other ones, a lot of other ones then, that's another seven or so that weren't really, and you still had a great time with the tournament. Now, is that a reflection on the game? Is that a reflection on the exhaustion of your opponents late through the night? So
I think in the Swiss, there were those blowout games that were just unfun, because in 2.0, there is no way in hell you can come back if you got blown out. And in 1.0, it at least always felt like there was still something you can do. But in 2.0, sometimes you just get destroyed on turn one. Like, you have a mediocre start, and winter is coming you, and ice you, and then I march you, and then you're done. That game is over. So those are the three games I'm referring to here when I said I had four games before the cut that were fun.
Okay.
Three games were just blowouts, and then four games were actually strategic and fun. Then after the cut,
a blowout is not always simply the fact of the game. Like I watched a game at Worlds where someone completely screwed up on turn one, let a put to the sword through that was broadcast, and then lost themselves the game on turn one.
No, I'm not talking about situations like that. I'm really talking about
the game.
Nobody could have done anything about that. It was just, I had the better start, you got screwed.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So those games were actually the ones that happened after the cut when fatigue kicked in. And those are the other games I'm excluding from my fun and strategic list, because those games were, inspiring in the sense that I haven't seen. I don't even know how to put it. It was just embarrassing.
You may have summarized it once in saying that one opponent didn't figure out until plot seven, then they flipped confiscation, that confiscation would have hit ice.
Yeah,
I think that maybe something summarizes
the plays like that. And you have to really thoroughly understand this comment, you have to know that was the winner of Flea Bottom Freckers, I believe. So that was a 160-person tournament. He just forgot for five turns in a row that he could discard an attachment with confiscation. And that is just the level at which we played. Luckily, the only game of mine that was recorded that day, the finals, that was actually a pretty good game, because that was the time where I overcame my first deep sleep cycle and I became awake again, and we could actually have a good finals, which I found incredibly pleasant that we could give the crowd something to watch even at that late hour. But yeah, so those were like 4 to 5 games out of 12 that were really enjoyable or were fun and interactive.
So, Yanis, in playing a deck that has fewer potentials for a turn one blowout the way that you play it, both defensively and aggressively, you're unlikely to blow out your opponent on turn one, and you're unlikely to lose on turn one. Did you have a similar experience? I mean, what percentage of your games would you have said were strategical and interesting?
Yeah, I mean, what is strategical and interesting? I would say I had fun in pretty much all my games, even included the final, even though I didn't draw anything I needed. But the funny thing about the finals, I will talk about that first, was that pretty much between plot 4 and plot 6, I knew if I draw Melisandre, I'm still in this game. So I knew I'm not too far away, I can still win, and that makes the game interesting. It's always super stupid if you know it doesn't matter at all what I draw, I'm out of this game. And I think that's what Florian meant, that when you're just dead, basically, because you can't draw anything that helps you. As long as you have outs, it's good. But in my Joust games, I had mainly fun. I mean, there were a few things, like in my first round, I played against a Spanish player, and she didn't speak English at all, and that made the game a bit tricky. But that's sometimes the case in Starlight, that there are language issues, but that's fine. And I had one blowout game in, like, I'm not sure which round it was. I had one game where I just had a super good setup, like a 6-card setup that had all in it what I could ever dream of, and my opponent had like a 1 or 2-card setup. And this game was just so hilariously one-sided, that wasn't really fun, because he couldn't do anything. I don't think he won a single challenge this game. So, I mean, that's not fun, but it happens very rarely. And usually when you play the deck I play, it's actually pretty fun because when the opponents don't know the deck, even if you are comfortable in the position you are, the opponents usually think they are winning until like plot 5 or something. So it's basically a situation where both players think they are in a good position and it's a real game. Mm. And the blowout for the opponent just happens in plot 6 or plot 7 when they realize, oh god, I don't have characters with icons anymore.
Probably the reason why I won, because I felt like losing the entire game. Literally until the last plot, even when I revealed that, I was still scared that something could happen that would just completely take me out of the game.
I knew pretty much I knew pretty much after I didn't find the red keep with building orders that I was in trouble against you.
Hmm.
And when I then in that turn where you milked Nymeria and killed somebody with ice, and I decided to kill Nymeria because I had to play my close call anyways, and thought I'm like 25 cards in my deck anyways already. There's a big chance that I draw Nymeria or Melisandre again. And I couldn't have unmilked her anyways until plot 8. And then I didn't draw any of those again. I knew I was in trouble. I mean, you didn't realize how much in trouble I was, but I pretty much only had reduces.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was still a good final because, I mean, we both made almost no mistakes, I think. And
yeah, I think there was like one major up, but other than that, I can't really remember any major mistakes.
So out of curiosity, mistake the order in which you resolved the March plots?
He made me first player, and then I resolved the March plot. And the thing is, I mean, it was technically a bit better for me to do Wildfire first and then March, because as I said, I didn't have any characters that were like more than 2 cost. But on the other hand, my deck hates it to be first player. So I'm not even sure it's a mistake by him to make me first player and then get a character of his marched that doesn't have icons anyways.
And then be able to marshal one afterwards that will have icons.
Yeah, and then I'm first player. I have like 4 attachments in hand, but he has a character that already has no icons, and Gravent, who can't take attachments. So I think it was probably the right move in hindsight.
Well, that's the question that I wanted to ask, because we were discussing this as we were getting Helmut's live typoing, I like to call it, about the match, in which Yanis was, of course, referred to as Yanina.
I read that afterwards.
But basically, we were there saying, wait, you know, some people were like, oh, he screwed up, or Helmut said, oh, he screwed up and let his opponent go first and therefore control the Wildfire Marched order. And we were debating which situations it was better to do it one or the other. So I'm going to decide whether it was a screw-up or not as to whether or not Florian intended to let that go happen or not.
I mean, immediately after initiative, he said, oh, God, no, when he realized that I would do it in that order. So I think he was pretty sure he made a mistake. And in that second, I also thought he made a mistake. But when thinking about it later, I don't think it was that big a mistake, if even at all. So
yeah, I know that I ejaculated, oh my god, what did I do? This is the worst in that moment. So maybe that had an impression on Helmut.
And that wasn't a bluff. That wasn't you going, oh my god, what have I done?
No, that wasn't a bluff. Okay, right. I was fairly convinced that I screwed up. One more thing. I have an interesting theory why Janice claims that he had more fun over the course of the tournament. Because I think that's what having a control deck in an aggro meta does.
Yeah.
Because here you really see the power of asymmetry. When you have decks that don't work entirely the same way, the game becomes much more open and the people have different objectives, and that makes the game much more dynamic, and it opens up much more space for each player to develop their strategy, and that makes the game more fun. That's the opposite of just playing aggro against aggro, where
or control
who gets the better start just wins.
It's not only that, it's also that pretty much all my opponents had no idea what they were playing against when the game started, because, I mean, this could have been a pretty standard Baratheon list with Stannis in it and just throwing in Nymeria and a few of the good Martell characters, but it wasn't. And especially, I mean, that I might now sound like a bad person, but the look on the opponent's face when the second Wildfire hits is priceless. Because that's usually the point where they realize, oh god, I'm in trouble.
That's actually something we could touch on briefly. That winds up making a deck like yours really good at making the cut. It has a surprise element in it. that people aren't necessarily expecting, or at least weren't expecting initially in their first turn or two until they saw the icon attachments come out and then might maybe suspect you have the second Wildfire. Was that different in the cut? Were you playing against opponents who knew you had that second Wildfire, who were pacing their attachment control better? Or was were they basically, they didn't have a way to deal with that, and so it didn't really matter how they played?
First of all, I mean, the deck can deal with most attachment control pretty well, because, I mean, if the opponent's deck has Rattleshirt's Raiders, for example, they still have to win a challenge, and they are a character. So I can kneel them, I can take the icon away with my Myria, I have two times in the name of your king, which just shuts down the military. So I don't think all day a Rattleshirt's Raider took even a single attachment of mine, because they usually don't win the challenge if I don't want to. And the other thing people run that takes away attachments is Sonfiscation, which is one plot, and it takes away one attachment. And oftentimes the opponents play it on turn two when they don't realize which attachment they actually have to take away. And then they take away a milk from a character that ends up with no icons anyways. So, I mean, and to the other thing of spreading the word, I think in the cut, most opponents actually knew I had two Wildfires. I think the only one who didn't know it was Florian in the finals.
Yeah.
He was pretty surprised when I turned my last plot over, because I Wildfired the second time at plot 7. And he was, oh, you're running second Wildfire. It was like, you didn't know that by now? I think everybody in the room knows. But
so it does sound, Florian, like you're a big fan of control and that you'd be looking for control. Does that mean your card design will be in that vein?
Oh, I wouldn't say I'm a big fan of control. I'm a big fan of diversity, because what makes control great and what makes aggro great and what makes rush great is that you can play those deck archetypes against each other. And so you create a dynamic game state. So if you only have control in the meta isn't much better than if you only have aggro. What really makes the meta great is when you have different archetypes. And so, well, currently I would probably have to design a control card to make the meta more diverse. I don't think I'm going in that direction, but it's also only been a week. So I'll see what I can do to make this game hopefully a little brighter and a little better.
Just make an interesting card and not a stupid, efficient one that is just boring but so good you can't not include it. I mean, that would be stupid.
Viper reprint. Bitches.
All right. So I'm going to close off with a question that I've asked everyone who's attended Stalic this year. Maybe starting with you, Yanis. Stalic 2016, what was it for you? What do you remember it for? What stood out from 2016 for you?
It was a great tournament again, but there was one little episode I want to share, but just because it was so absurd that it was great. I mean, after the final was gone, I was sitting with Helmut and two other German guys in the Rittersaal, and we were sharing stories of previous Starlix and stuff, and we were doing this for a long time, and suddenly at like 5:30 in the morning or something like that, the door to the Rittersaal opened, and a Swede came in and said like, oh, I didn't know you were here. I just wanted to play piano. And then he went to the piano and started to play piano for like half an hour while we were sitting there and talking. It was great. It was so absurd, but it had the right feeling. And that's also Starlic. It's just a lot of strange but super nice people meet up, and it's just like a big family, and I love it. I can't imagine not going there every year, to be honest.
And then Florian, what was Starlic 2016 for you? What will you remember it for?
You've already quoted me on this one, but I actually think I will remember how I interacted with the people, because to be totally honest, you haven't been to Starlic until you have been to Starlic. It's just so much more than a tournament. It's this one time in the year where the entire family gathers and you play the game that you love with the people that you love, and everyone's just having a great time. It's at this point not even as much as a tournament for me as it's just this one time in the year where your hobby actually becomes home.
I do apologize. In recording this track, there's a little bit of choppiness on the guest's side. It does fade in and out. It's an artifact of the recording and not of anything I can modify in post-production. So I'm joined here today by Eliza, or Eliza, I suppose you were called at Stalik, freshly returned from the biggest Thrones tournament of the year. Was this your first Stalik? Was this...
No, that was my fourth Stalik.
Oh, okay. So yeah. And how often have you played on the European Team Championship?
This was my first time playing on the ATC.
Now, if I understand correctly, the history of this European Team Championship, it was initially developed by the Greeks. It was brought to Stalik about 3 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Were you a part of that, of the organization efforts, or who should we credit for those?
No. Only Ogio is the one to credit. It was entirely his idea, and he approached Wolfgang and arranged to make it happen. I was just assisting in some things, but not really part of the organization.
So do you happen to know, you know, what the idea of, did the idea of team games already exist in Greece, or was this basically his brainchild?
Not specifically for Game of Thrones, but I think Gio got the idea from his earliest days in card gaming during the Lord of the Rings LCG.
Ah, well, I've been very interested with this, and in fact, the format has caught on a little bit more. This year there was a team championship in the UK, and next year it looks like there's going to be one in the Netherlands as well. So more and more countries are doing them as local events to sort of lead up and get the Stalik experience, because obviously not everyone can play in the Stalik version.
This is very nice news.
Yeah, it looks like it's very, very popular. I don't think it can quite live up to the same Stalik experience, because over the years people have told me what a great effort the Greeks have put into it, but more and more teams are coming, all wearing the same shirts, the flags. I mean, the Greeks have the anthems playing. There's the rivalry between countries, and that there's the ambiance is very special and very much, someone described it almost like a football game, really.
You actually got it correctly.
and the Greek team had absolutely fantastic equipment, a really nice logo on the shirts and looked fantastic. So you guys were prepared to win. You had the...
Yeah, we took great pride in that. It was so pretty.
I think one of the happy stories is, you know, this really has been the baby of the Greek team for 3-4 years now, I think 3 years. And to have them, I know they made the finals in the first year, and now to actually win it a few years later is great. So who was on the team this year?
So I was the fourth player, and there were three other guys, Agelos, Nikos, and Gregory.
Were these the including yourselves, the top four seeded Greeks, or were these the four Greeks that people could actually get to wake up on the Sunday?
I'm not entirely sure about the ranking. I know I was ranked next with Gio, but Gio gave his place because he had to organize and run the whole thing. So I technically I played in his place. I'm not sure if there were other people in between. The other three guys, they were the first. They could play. We all woke up. We were just there.
Excellent. All right. Now, of all the interviews that I've received, and several people have mentioned that there was a very memorable event that happened on Sunday. Not specifically Thrones related, but that within the Greek squad there was a proposal.
Yes, there was, and the people of Stalik assisted to that.
The people of Stalik assisted to that. So would you care to tell me a little bit more? Because everyone has told me you'll have to ask the Greeks. You'll have to ask the Greeks. So I'm asking the Greeks.
Really? And you're asking kindly the wrong person, because I was on the tournament, so I didn't see it firsthand, but I know what happened.
Well, that's better than I'll get from anybody else. So pray do tell.
It was one of the guys, and not the guys I was with, because we came from two separate areas of Greece. But we always meet at Stalik for the tournament. And this guy and his girlfriend were there every year. And he arranged for every volunteer that wanted to get some pieces of heart that were writing, I love you because, and on the back, the reason he loves her. And her friend took her to the path down to the main city, to the main town from the castle. And while she was walking, people were handing her the hearts. And she was crying. It was very emotional. I don't know if you can put that on the podcast, but I heard that one of Boris guys was crying.
I think you can. We can put that on the podcast. We don't necessarily need to say who it was, but we can say one of the Polish guys. There were many Polish guys. Their anonymity is protected.
Okay. And She said yes. She said yes.
Oh, good, good. That was going to be my next question. I think the way that people have referred to it is really quite nice in saying that a lot of the people who go to Stalic year after year really do feel like this is a community event. This is their friends. This is their family. And it's the people that they want to share these sorts of big events with. And so it's very touching to see a proposal happen at an event of that size.
And, it was very nice, and everyone cooperated so nicely, and so many volunteers, and this is exactly what you said, it's a community.
I'm curious as to whether there were any particular storied matchups, bitter rivalries within teams. You know, if there's some highlights of the actual team championship games, either the ones that you played or the ones that you got to watch, that are worth recounting, you know, some of those epic events that make the story.
Well, I can tell you about mine. It was not really epic, but I played in two games in the tournament, and one I lost, the other I won, but in the one I lost, it was actually really funny for us, because in the team event you are allowed to talk with your teammates and discuss strategies, not with other people, but for the four people that are on your team. And we were playing, I think, against Sweden. I was discussing with Angelos a specific strategy. I was a little behind on that game, and we made a completely wrong choice, and made a huge misplay, and I lost that game after that.
But the nice thing is that now you can blame Angelos instead of yourself.
Yes, I can, but I won't. It was a team effort.
All right, a team.
It was funny for us. We were discussing it so deeply and what we should do. They did the completely wrong thing.
So, who did you guys play against in the final in the end?
Poland.
Poland, okay, all right. Possibly one of the Polish guys who cried, we won't say anything.
I don't know nothing. The last game was so intense. It was very intense. Not against Poland specifically. It was just, I don't know how to describe it. It was an amazing experience and feeling. There was so much tension and so much sweating and focusing. It was a rivalry, but because we really, really wanted to win. Mm-hmm. And all the guys played, I believe, I was only a consultant on the final. But all the guys put the best effort for this win.
Well, it sounds to me like one of the great aspects of the team championship is that it does sort of become a good event for the audience as well. You have a team that you can root for and several games to watch, and one of them's bound to be exciting. And because there's sort of three matches going on, it's not just all hanging on one game, so you always have something to watch. So I would say that my biggest disappointment is that I don't think I've ever seen a recording of one of these matches. And I know that Stalic has bad internet, and I know that it's difficult, but that would be my begging to the organizers, is to let us watch those games, even if it's not live, to see one of those 3v3 matchups. I would love to be able to at least participate as an audience member.
Yeah, and this, your request is noted. I will pass that to Gio. I believe he has that in mind as well. It's not only the internet, it's the equipment and stuff, but he will not disappoint.
There's one question that I've asked everyone that I'd like to close off with, and that's what they will remember Stalic 2016 for. What for you, you know, you've been to several Stalics, what will 2016 be for you, looking back?
Being seeing it a little objectively, I was playing in the team event, and it was a new experience for me. And honestly, being on the audience last year, I couldn't appreciate it as much as playing. Not that I didn't enjoy it the other times, but it really was an amazing experience. And it's very nice to hear that the other countries are also implementing it. Mm-hmm. The moment for me that I will remember for 2016, it's me picking up the cup and the guys lifting me up.
Well, there's video evidence of that.
Yeah.
Looks
so that's
like
what I remember.
Everybody is really happy at that moment. So that's a fitting...
I think it shows in my face.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I was going to say Eliza again, but I guess everyone's calling you Eliza.
Stalic is Eliza. Nothing else.
Stalic is Eliza. All right.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Well, that wraps up our Stellisode. Stellisode. We'll go with that. This gave you as much excitement for Stalic as it does to me. You should look. The dates for next year's Stalic have already been posted, although registration is not yet open. And the additional legs on the Road to Stalic tour, the one in Bulgaria and the one in Scotland, the dates have also been posted for those. Now, cast-wise, I don't actually know if we have another episode next week. I think we do. I'm actually not sure whether it's next week or the week after. Normally, we would take a break until store championship season started. But this year, with the new timing, I'm not actually sure what's going on. We did have some preliminary chats about it, and we weren't able to finalize anything in the last few days, especially with both of my co-hosts gone. So I can only leave you as to there will probably be an episode either next week or the week after. And that will probably be our season finale. Probably. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
I'm uniquely suited to the situation. I've got experience in riot suppression. I speak Russian and I'm white. You know, nobody else is a better fit for that world right now. Oh, absolutely. You know, once you get to the point in the night where people have to be fished out of the river by the police and you start to appreciate then the kind of individual contribution that everybody brings to the event, where you discover that one of the guys in attendance actually happens to be a lawyer in his non-Thrones time, and he eventually talks down the police from arresting the people that had to fish out the river. It's little things, you know?